And we are back with episode 371 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, who has reactivated his search for the new Rubicon.
Yes, that sounds like a great idea, considering the fact that the replacement doesn't seem to be, well, living up to standards lately. We're going to go ahead and start with just the two of us again. For those of you who may be waiting for Gary or Bronstone to show up, I'm sure that sometime this week they will. When, I'm not exactly sure, but there we are. Obviously, this is Critical Myth, your favorite spot to stop for pop culture commentary, mainly on television shows, and we've got quite a lineup this week. We're going to go ahead and get started, though, with Edmund and his usual disclaimer. Go ahead.
As always, it is our policy to discuss anything that happened in these episodes, whether we like it or not. As a result, you will be horribly spoiled if you haven't seen it, but we try and wait at least a week or so we certainly hope you have.
That's right, and we are going to go ahead and get started with a show that is the one that we were referring to largely, and that is Homeland. And let's go ahead and run the promo.
What's the purpose of your visit to the United States?
Business.
I need your eyes on Carrie. The Iranians are watching her too.
I'm not talking to you. Why aren't you in the nut house where you belong?
We have surveillance all over you.
Target's on the move.
They realize you're not who you're supposed to be. They'll just kill you.
I'll do whatever it takes.
Did I get made?
She's on her own soul.
She's always been on her own.
All right, and that is Homeland Season 3, Episode 5, The Yoga Play. Yes, I'm sorry, there's a dearth of yoga pants in this particular episode, as much as some of us may have liked to have seen that. But anyhow, a mysterious man enters the country at the U.S.-Canadian border. Carrie puts her mission on the line to do a risky favor. Saul is forced to socialize with his adversary, Senator Lockhart, on an elite hunting trip, and Dana makes a shocking discovery that could end her getaway for good. And hey, Edmund, you know what? Here's a lesson that I learned from Homeland. When you're in the middle of an operation that has been really reliant on all kinds of coincidence and luck, the very first thing that you should do is go completely off mission and help somebody in a way that completely goes against the notion that you're completely nuts.
Yes. Especially if it's at the request of the wife of the person you went completely nuts with.
That's right. The wife of the person that now pretty much the entire country knows that you were having an affair with because it was on C-SPAN.
Yes.
Not that the entire country watches C-SPAN, but I'm fairly sure that that story, once it got out, would have been all over the news.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
Come on. It's, you know, juicy political stuff. It definitely, and, you know, right now our intelligence agencies are kind of the whipping post for just about everyone on the internet, if not the mainstream media. I'm sure that it would have gotten back to Brody's wife that, oh yeah, hey, Carrie was sleeping with your husband.
Yeah.
Not that she didn't already suspect that anyway. But yeah, that was my big hang-up with this episode. What were they thinking?
Mm-hmm. Oh, exactly. Well, I mean, it's been kind of the open question of why is Dana's storyline here and why is it so prominent anyway? And, you know, this is almost like, you know, I can't even say attempt to justify it, but it was more like, well, it's there, so we should just, you know, bring it all together.
I guess. I don't know if they were trying to make Dana's storyline more palatable or merge it with what else was going on so that there was some kind of relevance to it all. But, I mean, come on. They take this direction with it so that now this guy that she met in the institution that she kind of fell into this self-destructive relationship with turns out to be a complete psychopath, and if that's not bad enough, then yeah, Brody's wife comes along and asks Carrie, of all people, to, hey, can you drop everything and help figure out what's going on or help find Dana, mm-hmm. and help her out, and
yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, you know, I've only gone through absolute hell for the last several weeks, had my reputation drug through the mud, all to get to this delicate point where these people that were related to the terrorist bombing are, you know, right there recruiting me and everything, and yeah, let's just completely jeopardize all of that with this thing with Dina.
And
do they justify it?
No, yeah, you know, I guess I was thinking, like, you know, okay, so maybe, you know, it's going to be some example of, you know, no, there's some insight that Carrie has that leads to them finding her, and it's nothing of what she does leads up to that. You know, it's like, no, you know, Dana just runs up to some cops because she just heard on the news that her boyfriend's probably a psycho. it just became incredibly pointless, and even within the mission, I mean, the whole thing of, you know, yeah, you know, waiting as long as they did, so that, yes, oh yes, you know, they you know, the very last minute or past the last minute, as far as Virgil's is concerned, you know, she does get to the agent, you know, so, you know, but which is only so we can have the, oh no, the, you know, the guy staking out the yoga studio is going to see that it's not Carrie, but oh no, by the last split second it is,
right?
So, you know, just in the service of, you know, a basically kind, you know, kind of cheap little shock moment.
It keeps coming to mind. Cheap, but anyway, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, except for the fact that, you know, what was, you know, then even more heinous was, you know, Peter Quinn, who, you know, has been so far, I think, the, you know, the more intriguing character this season. You know, but, you know, he's the, I mean, he basically, you know, kind of came very close to jeopardizing things anyway with his ham-fisted attempts to keep the guy at bay, you know? which involved driving up to his door so that he has to get out the passenger side.
Yeah.
I mean, I mean, just on every level, I mean, that whole thing just did not make any sense. You know, even in terms of it, you know, once it comes down to, you know, the actual meeting, I mean, then it, you know, the whole crack about yoga, it was almost like, you know, yeah, that was another thing where the whole thing was set up, you know, just so he can say that, and you have to wonder, oh, does he know, doesn't he know?
Yeah. It was just, this is what we're worried about when we say going to the, you know, 24 writing model of, yeah. Let's put ourselves into pin ourselves in a corner and then have to try and write ourselves out of it with pretty much no time to make any course corrections or anything. And that's exactly what this felt like. So, yeah, I don't even know where to go from there. There was really nothing else in the episode that, I mean, it was,
yeah, I mean the actual I mean, you know, when Carrie gets taken, I mean, you know, that whole strip search and, what was rather terrifying, you know, and I thought, you know, rather well played by Claire Danes, you know, but that doesn't make up for the rest of it.
No, not entirely. You know,
and, yeah, and even the whole thing of, you know, Saul showing up at the duck shoot and discovering, you know, he's the target, not the shooter, basically.
metaphor that I have ever seen. I mean, come on, that was really like beating you over the head with the symbolism of that whole duck shoot thing. Come on. I mean, it was good enough, but there's this artificial nature to everything. I mean, because now I understand that it wasn't it enough the fact that Saul was going to feel as if he had to do something flashy in order to regain the trust of the government and keep the, as ridiculous as this is, keep the CIA from being shut down, as if that was going to happen anytime soon. But okay, setting that aside, let's just say, so no, let's ramp this up with Saul having his job now on the line, somebody else being in charge who really doesn't like him at all and is not going to back his play whatsoever. So now he's on, mm-hmm. what, a two-week, do you want to call it, two-week deadline in order to make this all happen, because that's when his replacement's going to take control. So it's this artificial deadline now that's in place that is going to narratively justify what, the, you know, this idea that he can kind of go off script completely because the ends justify the means. It's so far afield of what from the good old days of the first season, that's for sure.
Oh yeah, well for first season and the first four episodes of season two,
right?
I mean, you know, through Q&A and that amazing interrogation, you know, that's when it seemed like the show was, you know, was the one we started with, and you know, and then it just started to fall apart, and unfortunately just really feel like it's still disintegrating. And I do feel that for the people who are hanging in there with this one, what I was referring to in the opening was an AMC show called Rubicon that Henry Bermell, who used to write for Homeland before his untimely passing, you know, was brought on board for, and was one reason, especially after the, you know, the initial season and a third, you know, I thought, you know, that Homeland might be the show that actually could replace Rubicon, but sadly, all we have now is to go back to that truncated first season of both Rubicon and Homeland.
Yeah. Well, let's put it this way. I mean, the stuff at the very end with Carrie in isolation was some very tense material. They really played with the idea of the vulnerability of the character in that moment. And everyone was trying to sell this. I mean, that's the one thing that kind of also drives me insane about all of this, is that, you know, the cast in general is fairly good. I mean, they have an excellent cast. So just the fact that they take this whole writing style and the seat of your pants, make it work kind of atmosphere, and for whatever reason, you know, both on 24 and now on Homeland, these people that are otherwise fairly good at what they do, I don't know if it's because they have to, it really pushes them as actors to try and pull this kind of thing off, if, you know, the fact that they've gotten lots of awards, I don't know, but why they don't seem to have an issue with this, and how little sense anything seems to make, I don't know.
Yeah. I could go all pop psychology and say it's got to be some sort of Stockholm syndrome, because, you know, they're basically trapped in this show with writers who can't tell them what's going to happen because they don't know yet. And so, you know, they've just gotten used to, you know, waiting for that next script to come out, and, you know, just turn off the rational part of their brain in terms of whether it makes any sense, and just, you know, act those words for all their words.
I guess so. Where are the Emmys typically filmed or held? Maybe the Stockholm syndrome isn't the right word for it. Back syndrome? I don't know. But anyhow, I gave this one a 6 out of 10, and I was between a 5 and a 6 the whole way. But I think that last scene did finally bring me back up. But what would you give it?
Yeah, I think I can agree with that reasoning. I mean, yeah, it's for most of it, it felt like a 5, and then when she was taken, that did notch it up slightly. So I'll say a 6 as well.
Yeah, and you know, while I'm on the subject, just we got a little bit of time since we're waiting for Gary, but one of the things right now I'm reading is actually a kind of surprising book that came out that I didn't even know was supposed to come out, and I just kind of happened upon it, and that's it's a Homeland book, but it's a prequel. It's set in 2006 or 2007, somewhere around there, so it's before you know, the events of the show, certainly, but it's kind of Carrie in crisis, I guess you could say, and how she rose to the position she was at the beginning of the series. And I'm just reading that, and while it has its moments of you know, watered down for the masses, I guess you could say, but it's written by a fairly well-known thriller writer, Andrew Kaplan, I believe his name is. So, I mean, it does have all the hallmarks of this of the show from its first season. And I'm just kind of reading along, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, so this is what the show used to remind me of, and here's the way the show is now. So we'll see. You know, I'm only about halfway through that, so we'll see if it manages to maintain its current, you know, level of quality. But certainly, the show needs a shot in the arm. At least that's how I feel about it.
All right. Yeah, definitely.
Oh, we've got a little bit of time here. What I suppose we could do, because, you know, hey, we got to keep our listeners on the toes, right? Or on their toes, not on the toes, but anyhow. I'm just going to switch right over to the quick hits. Ha! Weren't expecting that, were you, people? No, neither was I. But at any rate, we're going to go ahead and start with American Horror Story, Season 3, Episode 3, The Replacements. Fiona takes on an unlikely protege. Meanwhile, Zoe tries to help Kyle. Why does FX have to do this, too? Yeah, no, no kidding, right? Kyle, trapped in the most just disturbing subplot ever. Nadim gave this one a 9 out of 10. He's loving this season. And clearly you are watching this time around.
Yes, absolutely. And I'd be good with the 9 as well. I'm just realizing if I'm trying... I was having to do in my head which episode this actually was, but yes, I would definitely say a 9 out of 10.
Yeah, this one was pretty good, and it had a real twist at the end. I was not expecting a certain character to bite it.
Yep.
I was a little upset.
Well, we are allowed to spoil, don't forget.
That's true. Madison, damn it. You're going to kill off the hottest girl on the show. Come on, what's wrong with you? Although I do have to say that Stevie Nicks chick is, run for the money there, but...
Yeah, yes. Definitely. And actually, I also love that little detail as well. After all of the her reputation of basically coming out saying, yeah, of course she's one of us.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, certainly. Just the way they set that up. I mean, showing Fiona's path to becoming the Supreme, and then the reversal at the end, discovering just how much Fiona likes being the Supreme, was really well done. And although I have read some speculation that this is certainly one of those shows where just because you're dead doesn't mean you're not coming back.
Yeah, well, there's two things that came to my mind after this was that number one. How do we know she's going to stay dead when she was literally just involved in a resurrection spell? So, foreshadowing pops up possibly. Mm-hmm. And then there's the second thing was how do we know she was even the new Supreme?
Anyway, yes.
That was a bit of an assumption, and I have a feeling that this being the third episode of the season, probably not a very well-founded one.
Yeah,
but there we are. I gave it an 8. I mean, I was definitely between an 8 and a 9, and no, it wasn't just because they killed off Madison. The subplot with Kyle was really just, there's a certain point with this show, and one could really say this about a number of the subplots and or any episode of this of American Horror Story, but do they try to go just a little over the top just for the sake of being edgy? Yes.
Yeah,
but to me, sometimes it fits the story, and then other times it just feels like baiting the audience. Like, see how edgy and crazy we can be? And that's kind of what the stuff with Kyle felt like. It's like, it was completely unnecessary to the story. Completely. And it was only there just to be, disturbing and to get a rise out of the audience. And, yeah, that kind of annoys me. And it's a tendency that American Horror Story has had since the beginning. It's like, if it fits the story, even if it's a little bit of a stretch, great. But if it's something like that where it's done literally just to spice things up in the horrific vein, it does get on my nerves. But anyway, I gave it an 8, which is still above average, so it didn't bother me that much.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'll just say my take on that is more, it's I kind of knew its over the top reputation coming in, so I think I may be giving it a little more latitude than some.
Fair enough. Okay, so let's see here. We've got then the next one here. This is a little bit surprising. Scandal, Season 3, Episode 4, Say Hello to My Little Friend. A philandering senator who takes risque photos of himself becomes Olivia's latest client. Elsewhere, Melly becomes entangled in a scandal with a congresswoman. Well, one would think so, given the title of the show. Nadim gave this one a 7 out of 10, and I think that he was actually probably, in reading his review, between more of a 6 and a 7 in this one. He really just did not like this episode. There was a lot about it that he felt was subpar. And I don't know how much of it was still momentum that was allowing him to give it even an average rating. So, yeah, that was a little bit of a drop. So for those who think that he's just universally praising the show no matter what, nope, he does drop it down when the time is right. A show that has not needed to be dropped down this week is The Vampire Diaries, Season 5, Episode 4, For Whom the Bell Tolls. On this show, who knows? It could be anybody. Elena and Damon attempt to help Stefan through a confusing time. Matt tries to figure out the reason behind his mysterious blackouts. Caroline makes an effort to get to know Jesse better. Jeremy makes a startling confession. Dr. Maxfield puts in motion a plan that threatens to change everything. Yeah, Nadim gave this one an 8 out of 10, but even he felt that there was one glaring annoyance in this episode, and that was the... there was a funeral, a memorial for a character that was killed at the end of last season, who continues to show up as a ghost in the show as if she's a main character and she's around all the time. Now, if they had a nice little, like, you know, short scene memorial just to maybe acknowledge that the characters needed the closure and all that, fine. No, this thing dragged on forever. It was at least an entire segment of the show, and it just didn't stop. And no matter what else good was going on the show, and there was some pretty good stuff going on, that just, to me, knocked it down to a 7 out of 10. So Nadim gave it an 8, I gave it a 7. It's so maybe I need to take back what I was saying at the top of this particular commentary. Because I forgot why it is that this one was the one that I dropped down. Okay, also running right in the average vein was the, and this was a little bit of a surprise to me, The Return of Grimm, Season 3, Episode 1, The Ungrateful Dead. The third season opens with Juliet, Monroe, Rosalie, and Hank frantically fending off zombies while Captain Renard works to rescue Nick. Meanwhile, Adeline takes on a grisly task in an attempt to regain her powers. All right, well, let's see. I gave this one a 7 because for a premiere episode, this felt like the middle of a three-part story. Okay, now the finale last year was two parts long as it was.
Okay.
And set up this whole idea that there were people that were basically zombified, and it ended with Nick, the main character, this grim, zombified himself and captured by, you know, the enemy, for all intent purposes. All right. This episode was... because he's a Grimm, he wasn't fully zombified, he was only partially zombified, but he escaped and basically went on a little bit of a rampage.
Okay.
Meanwhile, everybody else, which finally they have the entire team of support, you know, players, basically acting as his Scooby gang, and everybody's in, finally they get to this point after two seasons, and all they do all through the premiere is fight off these zombified people. Again, and again, and again. That's they're doing the whole time. Now, they eventually find a cure for it, which is great and all, but it's like, wow, there really wasn't a whole lot to the episode. It was fine, it was good, but it was like, wow, this, it's not resolving anything quite yet. So it really was a middle chapter of a longer story, so it just wasn't up to par for me. Yeah. It was at par. Let's put it that way. It wasn't above par or below par. Whatever. It was a 7 out of 10 for me. I was a little disappointed in that one.
Thank you.
So let's see. Hey, is that Gary?
Yes, sir, it is.
All right. Welcome. We're already well underway here. And while we were waiting, we were actually just knocking off some quick hits. And I just got done describing my reaction to the season premiere of Grimm. Did you happen to pick it up?
It is on my DVR, but I have not had a chance to watch it yet.
Well, I won't tell you what my reaction was. I'll just leave that alone.
How about just a thumbs up or a thumbs down? I'll settle for that.
How about a thumb still sideways?
Ooh.
Dead average for me.
Ooh.
Now I haven't seen the second episode, so I may feel differently about that. But the premiere was a bit of an average episode to me. It didn't come out of the gate, you know, on all cylinders or anything. So.
I'm disappointed. They came out so strong last season. Huh.
I know. It was a little weird.
Well, I guess that's the show, isn't it?
Yeah, right. Okay, well, you know what? We're not going to continue with the quick hits for right now. We'll pick up the last few later on, because now that Gary's here, we can actually jump into some of our headliner stuff.
Oh, geez, no pressure. Okay.
There's been some people waiting for this, I'm sure, for this entire episode. We're going to jump into... Let's play the promo of The Walking Dead.
Hyundai presents scenes from the next episode of The Walking Dead.
You find out who did this and you bring them to me. You understand?
I'm just digging graves. We can do something. We can fight.
I can't let you do this.
You don't have a choice. You breathe and you risk your life. The only thing you can choose is what you're risking it for.
Video, go to AMC.com.
All right, and let's see. That is The Walking Dead, Season 4, Episode 3, Isolation. One group leaves the prison in search of supplies, while those who stay behind try to preserve what remains. And Gary, since you just joined us, why don't you go ahead and start off? What did you think in general of the episode, and highlights, lowlights?
I think the biggest sort of revelation, at least I did not see it coming, was who had killed the two people. Is it Carol, I think it is?
Yeah.
Yep.
That just really, I just never expected it. And I guess, you know, as I look back, of course, they've been foreshadowing it as she talks about, you know, it's a different world. She, you know, as she was talking about how she's training the kids to, you know, to kill and defend themselves. But I never thought she would take quite that proactive a stance to kill, you know, kill these people to supposedly stop the infection. It came out of nowhere for me, and I really was just sitting with my mouth open when that came out. It just took me by surprise. Although that being said, the way it was handled between her and Rick, this just sort of matter of course type of conversation, it worked for me. It felt fitting for both characters who have been through so much through the show already that, in a sense, they're just numbed, numb to even something as insane as what happened. So I'd say that was the biggest thing that sort of caught my attention in this episode. The next biggest thing was, and it might not seem like a little bit seem as big a thing at the moment, but I think it is that when Michonne and Daryl went out to go look for medicine, they came upon this huge horde of zombies, this massive grouping. And while the one guy freezing up in the car was a little surprising, the fact that there is this large horde, as we've been seeing sort of wave after wave come up to the prison, I'm hoping it's giving us a little foreshadowing of some big thing or revelation about it. I know we've talked about a bunch of pet theories we've had as to why the prison is getting sort of assaulted by all these groups of zombies. And obviously, it doesn't seem like they're letting that clause go. So that was was probably the biggest development, which really they didn't play it up as much as I think they should have. At least I'm assuming it's a big development. What do you guys think? Am I totally off bounds with thinking that that's actually a bigger thing than they focused on this episode?
I can only say for myself, and I'll let Edmund jump in after this, but when you mentioned the fact that, you know, wow, they just keep seeming to have more and more zombies show up at the fence, I was beginning to suspect that this is where they were going with it. That there was this herd out there and not that far away. And even if it's if it's just, I think the way that I described it last time we talked about it was, you know, perhaps the leading edge was kind of out there. But, you know, it's been months since they've had anything major happen to that degree. And I'm wondering if, you know, just the ebb and the flow of all of these walkers, that they kind of congregated in one area and now they're moving closer and closer, and it's just going to take something to prompt them over there. And I know we kind of speculated that that something might be the governor of all things, but whatever the case, they've now, I forget how far away they said it was, what, 30 miles or something like that?
Where they were heading for was 50 miles. I mean, it's up in the air in terms of how far they actually got.
Well, so. Yeah, I got the feeling that they weren't quite there, and that they were just far enough away to feel mildly comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they started playing the radio, which we'll get to in a second. But, yeah, I don't think that they were, like, right at the place 50 miles away.
No.
I think it was someplace in between. And if you kind of look, it was kind of like a natural depression around the building. So it made me wonder if that was, it was just geographically, that's where it just happened to, they happened to congregate. But they were moving in the direction that they were coming.
Yeah.
So that tells me they're on the way. At least that's my suspicion. So yeah, that it definitely was an eye opener. That's for sure. Now, Edmund, how about you? And if you have any thoughts on that radio transmission, you might as well jump in with that too.
Oh, sure. The size of the herd or whatever you want, you know, call it, you know, was rather surprising, and I think kind of, you know, to my mind, kind of put the kibosh on the idea of that the governor was hurting them, because, you know, it's, I'm not sure he can you know, control that large a group. But certainly I did like the way they set that up of, you know, yeah, with them, you know, they're, you know, they're in the good car. It's like, you know, everything's going fine. And, you know, so, you know, and that sense of them being, you know, perhaps a little complacent after this many months of, things going okay. As this show has been want to do, just, you know, then having, you know, slam right up against this new complication. I certainly got the impression that, you know, they weren't close to where they needed to go. You know, they're kind of in between, so that now they're stranded. It's going to be an interesting decision of which way they go, although I would presume that, yeah, getting the medicine is the important part. But also the whole thing of Tyrese, sort of freezing in the car. This is one case where, you know, yes, even though they haven't been keeping to the, you know, the story from the comic books, you know, just kind of knowing how major a character he is. I thought that was getting a little silly in terms of, you know, it's like, you know, he's going to come through, you know. I mean, even though, yes, it was still awesome the way he did it. And, you know, I think we should all sing a chorus of "If I Had a Hammer" in honor of it. As far as the radio transmission, the concept that, you know, there might be still some sort of organization out there is certainly an intriguing one to bring in. I mean, after, you know, we everything's been just so focused on, you know, this group of people, you know, and then, you know, and certainly, you know, or even, you know, just them and Woodbury, and you know, it's like, you know, the entire world is just sort of, you know, clamped down to this, you know, portion of northern Georgia, basically. The idea there might be somebody capable of putting a radio transmission out there is, certainly another intriguing development, you know, when and if they deal with the coming tsunami of zombies.
Mm. Did Gary drop out?
No, I'm still here.
Oh, okay. Very strange. It sounded like you did. Oh, maybe there's a zombie Gary out there somewhere. But
But, you know, as we talk about that radio transmission for a second, we constantly – well, I shouldn't say constantly, but we've run across enough new people or exposed to new towns and things like that where I don't have a sense that this is that the world is abandoned from regular people altogether. I think – I've always believed that this episode sort of points out as we run across different individuals that there are still plenty of people out there. Take the, the most recent thing, that crazy woman in the woods. There are still – obviously not a big number, but there's still a fair number of regular people that have managed to survive throughout this whole thing. So when I heard that, it didn't strike me that it might be somebody else out there. We've seen so many other people sort of pop up that aren't zombies that I could believe that there could be more people out there.
Yeah, we don't know what it represents. It could be anything from some kind of minor installation that managed to survive to, just another, enclave that just happens to have a transmission tower or something. We don't know. All we know is that there was something, and,
maybe it's Sanctuary.
Yeah, there you go.
Sorry.
To me, it was also kind of strange that, in this is dramatic license, but they turn the radio on, and almost immediately they come across this. It's a little odd, but at any rate, it seems obviously very important that they get back to the prison with the medicine, like you were saying, Edmund, but also to give them this information. And unfortunately, none of the I think maybe there's one character there that's cannon fodder, but. Yeah, if I was that guy, I'd be looking at myself and going, oh, so of all the characters that are here in this little group, mine's the only one that's not either an established character or beloved.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, no,
by any chance, I can't recall.
I was trying to work a way to say that.
Yep. Yeah, and of course it would unfortunately return them to that unfortunate trend they had of, yes, you can only have one major black male character at a time. But maybe they'll surprise us. But.
Maybe they will. Technically speaking, I guess there's Michonne and Tyrese, so.
Oh, well, yeah, well, no. It's in terms of the black men in the cast.
Okay,
it's like,
then, yes.
If a new one gets introduced, one of the other ones dies.
It is the
role of them.
Yeah.
Beyond that, we then have what's going on at the prison, which that's some nasty stuff.
You mean the water coming out of that hose? Yeah, I agree with.
Yeah, that
was, sorry. That was. They haven't put a pipe in at this point. I'd say.
Yeah. Ooh. The one scene that keeps coming back to mind was when it's Herschel, right? That is in the no, not Herschel.
Well, Herschel was going in to treat them, but
yes, that's who. That is who I'm thinking of then. But where he's treating the one guy, and I think it's the doctor, and he coughs, and blood just splatters on his face,
mm-hmm.
and he just kind of gets that look in his eye, takes the mask off, and just keeps going.
Yeah, wipes it off. Yeah.
Well, damn. So much for not being exposed.
Yeah.
Is the handkerchief over the mouth really going to offer you severe protection in the first place? I mean, a slight amount, perhaps, at least respiratory. But you're not. You're when you're surrounded in a ward of it. I can't imagine that's giving you a great deal of prevention.
No, it was probably a foregone conclusion anyway. But what's kind of. Because I was actually talking about this with somebody else, is that, they were thinking, oh, so they get this and they die. And it kind of, we started talking about this, and it's like, there hasn't been an actual out-and-out plague that has been 100% lethal.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, yes, you may get it, and it may come close to killing you, but it doesn't necessarily kill you.
Yeah, and you recover. You got lots of antibodies,
Sooner or later you're going to find somebody that's going to make it through, right? The problem is that who's that going to leave behind? I mean,
right.
It's like there's two of us left. I'm sure they're not going to kill off most of the cast. I mean, that there's a lot of people back at the prison that they can kill off. At the same time, this does feel like just another big step down the road of making the prison almost completely non-viable going forward. I mean, it seems like even if they get through this, the place is tainted. They're going to have to leave.
Yeah, well, I mean, at this point, I mean, the way they're setting up, I mean, they're getting attacked from within and, we presume, attacked from without once the horde reaches them. But I just wanted to mention, I mean, in terms of other scenes, of the two sisters talking through the door, I thought was another beautifully done scene. Just a real indication, I mean, of you know, how far the main characters have come from, the second season stuck at the farm, with the quite justifiable criticisms of, it's too much people, sitting around talking. And it's like, this is people sitting around talking and actually meaning something. Yes, it's also because they've upped the ante considerably since then. But it was just a very well done scene. And two young women, trying to work out what they should do in this rather, tricky and distressing situation.
And Nadim gave this one a 9 out of 10. He thought that it was really quite good and kind of a trend since the season premiere. He was very happy with the previous episode too, obviously. Gary, what would you give this one, do you think?
I'm going to give it an 8. I think a 9's a little bit far for this. But all the different scenes were enjoyable and they seem to still be building and moving everything along for the season. So I know I liked it, but I just didn't, when I hit a 9 and 10 personally, it's got to be sort of over the top, and I didn't feel that about this.
Mm-hmm. And Edmund, how about you?
Yeah, I think I'm more comfortable with the 8 as well. I mean, sort of, on the 8 to 9 side of it, but there's a lot of good stuff going on, but in a way it also felt like, this was a bit of a setup. I mean, in terms of leaving the medicine group out in the woods and then leading up to Carol's confession, a rather terse confession, but bringing that out into the open, and now we've got to see how all that plays out over the next couple of episodes.
I do have to say, I was glad it didn't turn into a 20-minute moral type of, oh, how could you do that? Oh, I felt I did what had to be done. Did you kill him? Yeah. there was something to be said for its simplicity in the revelation too.
Well, I thought that they did a nice job, and I just want to point out, I think this one was written by Robert Kirkman, if I am correct. Oh. If this episode was a little bit ponderous, it was probably because he was actually getting a chance to play, and he wanted to kind of take his time with it. But I thought that he did a really good job of, throughout the episode, presenting Carol's moral basis and where she's at psychologically, just to kind of circle all the way back to what you were saying earlier, Gary, that she is acting in what she believes is the greater good of survival.
Oh, and consistently too. Yes. It's not coming out of nowhere. Like I said, they laid the foundation very well over the past few episodes that when that revelation came, and as I thought back after, I was sort of shocked that she was the one that did it. I said, no, it makes a lot of sense. It's all there. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hadn't had time to think about it too much, but I was kind of following the dots as the episode went along. So, when she said it, it was not a surprise, but it was a case of, from that handprint, and then just, thinking back on the way she'd been acting and the things she'd been saying. I did kind of appreciate that of, that they weren't going to drag it out. And it's just, and once you hear her admit to it, and it just makes perfect sense.
Well, you could sort of see it as the plague was going through and she had the two girls in to say goodbye to their father, was it? And, she was getting ready to put him down, it sort of showed, her compassion, but at the same time, she's going to do what has to be done. And so, it's been there. So I thought that was a good character writing. Often which shows all of a sudden you have some dramatic thing happen out of nowhere, and it wasn't the case here.
Yeah. It's, just the fact that she kind of put it to Rick about the, you know, when he says, we'll fix the water tomorrow, and she went and did it herself, and her reply mm-hmm. back, there may not be a tomorrow.
Right.
So it's like, you got to take care of things now to survive, or it may be too late. And it's a very fatalistic way of looking at it, but it's this ultra-pragmatic way as well. And, there, you know, to a certain extent, you got to kind of think about it. It's like, did she kill, you know, was she brutal in how she dealt with the two plague victims? Yes. But at the same time, if doing that had stopped the plague cold,
mm-hmm.
Could you really argue with it? Because that's kind of how you got to deal with that sort of situation. Letting them linger and letting people become exposed is not the smart move. Of course, it also, unfortunately, you know, makes you wonder about, you know, human empathy and compassion. And it's like, well, you know, did she have to do what she did? you know, the way that she did it, you know, but in her mind, she's making decisions that other people are not willing to make. That just yep. also takes her down a certain road, though. You know, it's how long before she becomes the next governor at that rate.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, I would agree with the 8, by the way. I thought it was a little slow-paced, just a touch here and there. I don't think it found quite the balance that they normally would be looking for, but I think that a lot of it was Robert Kirkman just enjoying playing in the sandbox. So,
yep.
There we are. We still have a little bit of time left in this particular hour, so let's go ahead then, and I'm going to let Edmund and Gary take the reins with this one. And here is the promo for the for at least this recent episode of Elementary.
Sherlock Holmes will do anything to solve this case.
Maybe you could come back in an hour?
No, I'm afraid I cannot. I'm thinking of taking my own life post-haste. Is that window open?
But first...
Unless you have a corpse I'm not aware of, you don't have a case.
He'll need a body.
You're not dead.
Why can't anyone be dead today?
A new Elementary...
And that would be Elementary Season 2, Episode 5, Ancient History. Holmes enters the dark world of the Polish mob to find a killer. Meanwhile, Watson helps a close friend track down a mystery man who swept her off her feet. And yeah, I've decided to move this up a little bit because, all I hear are great things about this show and how many people are actually watching it, so, might as well get a little bit more of a highlight. So, Edmund, why don't you get us started? Highlight, lowlight?
Sure. This was a pretty good episode. There was a, you know, we had it was sort of an intriguing premise in terms of Holmes, being not having had a case, so he's basically trying to literally drum one up, going through some cold cases, and then we find out he also has a running relationship with one of the attendants at the morgue, where he in exchange for playing chess, if Holmes wins, he gets to look through the corpses to see if he can find a murder to solve. And naturally, in the course of this, he does find a tattooed denizen of the Eastern European mob, the twist is that it's not actually kind of solving his murder winds up being the mystery. It's tracking down the circumstances of his murder and where that leads him. So it was sort of a backwards mystery, which was kind of a fun twist. And then the flip side was they're continuing, you know, working with the whole idea of Watson, you know, now being sort of, you know, getting established, you know, as a detective on her own right, in her own right, and having this friend approach her because she had the one night stand with this amazing guy a year ago, and would Watson help her tracking him down? And I must admit, where I was not expecting that to go where it did. It actually wound up being, you know, yet another character moment for Holmes and Watson, and which they've been doing very well. I mean, they, you know, that's part of what's, you know, what's helped distinguish the show is that mix of working on the case and then at the same time, you know, introducing, you know, new, you know, the, you know, introducing and building, you know, building the characters of Holmes and Watson in intriguing ways. And certainly this one, discovering that, yes, it was in fact Holmes who had seduced her friend a year ago. You know, it was definitely throwing, you know, an intriguing little wrench into the relationship, you know, nothing that, you know, it's not going to break anything, but just, you know, yeah, it was, you know, throwing in some new wrinkles for them to deal with, you know, just when they think they've worked out a decent partnership. But what did you think, Eric?
I have to admit, I've been really enjoying this show, but this episode left me a little flat. I mean, they always sort of turn things up on the edge, but it just seemed a little sort of formulaic, and the actual solving of the mystery, I mean, nothing really sort of stood out for me. I mean, it was there. We had the whole plot line of Watson as well with the friend, and I don't know if corny's the right word for it, but it just seemed a little too convenient as far as writing goes to have, you know, Holmes be the mystery man of her friend. It's just too tight a circle, and I have to admit, you know, it seems like they've been guilty of this a bit here and there as we get these sort of convenient things where, oh, this was the person Holmes talked with as a girl, or, you know, or, oh, he solved that case, you know, a year ago, or things like that. And they seem to be sort of looping back into Holmes's life more than I think they need to. It's a cute little gimmick every once in a while, but it seems like they're going to that well too often for my taste. I'd like it to keep moving forward and not constantly delving into their past. You want to know more about them on one hand, but at the same time, you know, I'm not looking for, you know, for a biography of them either. So I'd like them to keep moving forward a little bit and not, you know, go back to, you know what I'm saying? I'm trying to think, I'm coming a little short words. Basically, I'd like these ways they keep looping back into their old lives because of some recent event it's just a tired trope for me.
Yeah, I mean, I'll agree that I think, yeah, they have been doing it a little too much this season, but I think the way in this particular case, I didn't mind it this was really just looping back to you know kind of to the beginning of the show and just sort of reinforcing and establishing, you know, that Holmes' desire to find out a little bit more about Watson, you know, right at the beginning of their time together, which to my mind, I mean, kind of helps, you know, that establish, you know, that the interest was there from the beginning, you know, however much he might have been appearing standoffish, and helping to give us some background on he really was a little more invested than he appeared to be when they first met. But certainly the case itself, I mean, you know, it was, you know, the only real twist was sort of starting it from the other end. But I agree that, you know, no, it wasn't like it was, you know, a great deductive tour de force for them as they went through that part of it.
Yeah, I guess that, I mean, yeah, that, like I said, if you want to call that the A story, or yeah, just it wasn't up to its normal caliber, and maybe I feel they've been hitting it out of the park so much lately that maybe a pause was sort of inevitable. But I'm, yeah, you know, I was hoping that things would stay up, but there's always next week, I hope. But regardless, you know, it's a very good show. The dynamics between the two between Johnny Lee Miller and Lucy Liu are really good. I was just talking with someone about the show tonight, actually, at a party I was at earlier in the evening, and I was saying how much I enjoy Lucy Liu in this episode. And normally I cannot stand the actress at all, but her characterization is just so good, and her interactions are, you know, so believable and heartfelt that, you know, it's a joy to watch her in it.
Yeah, definitely.
So
I just wanted to say, I mean, because I do think this is one case where, I mean, you know, the length of the American season, you know, does give them a pretty daunting challenge, you know, having to come up with, you know, 22 episodes that are all, you know, sort of Holmes mystery caliber is something that, so yeah, I think we can give them a little bit of latitude that, you know, that they're not quite always going to hit it. They certainly do enough of the time.
And what do you think you would give this one?
I think I would give it the dead average 7.
Okay.
I'm gonna go a little bit lower and go with a 6.
Not the best debut scoring that I was expecting for this, but okay, that's fine. I'm not watching it, so I can't really speak to it, but yeah, okay. We'll see what Bronstum thinks when he gets a chance to...
It's just my expectations are so high for it that I think, you know, it might be tempering my number, because I know they can do great work.
Yeah, well, that gives them plenty of room to go from there. And we're going to go ahead and wrap up this particular show here, and when we pick up next time, we will be talking about shows such as Covert Affairs, and Gary and I have a little bit of debating to do on that.
Oh, just you wait.
Oh, yeah. Haven, of course. And then some more of our quick hits. And, hey, we might even have a little bit of time to actually sit and chat. Imagine that.
Wow.
Thank you, gentlemen, for all your help for this episode. And definitely, if you want to give us some comments, you can follow us on Twitter at Critical Myth, or you can go and like our page on Facebook. Again, that's Critical Myth.
You can give us feedback by visiting the website over at www.criticalmyth.com. Just check out the entries for the show and leave us a comment. If you can't find it, just go all the way up to the top of the page. There's a link there, and there is also a drop-down box for all of the shows we talk about. So please let us know what you think.
Or you can go over to the VOG Network page and go over to the forums, and we have a dedicated forum for the show. You can leave comments there for us.
You can also email your feedback to feedback@criticalmyth.com, or you can leave us a review on iTunes.
Or you can call our Google voicemail line at 908-977-MYTH. That's 908-977-6984.
And don't forget that Critical misuse of any and all copyright material is only intended for parody, news analysis, critique, or for educational purposes, as provided within United States Code Title 17, also known as the Fair Use Act. Please don't sue us.
And the comments and opinions of the Critical Myth podcasters and reviewers are not necessarily those of its distributors, partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. So until next time...